Got it.
Now, two of us, do we have Chris or?
Yeah, he's hosting it, so he's there in the background someplace.
Somewhere in the background. All right.
Hi, Jim.
Yeah, okay. Hi. I don't see you, though. We need you, Chris.
Can you see my little head there, Jim?
There you are now, yeah. But then we lost Rick.
Oh, I'm still here.
Yeah, okay. Well, looks like we're ready to go.
Well, Jim, so nice to see you. And Rick, thank you for coming on. Really, really a lot of fun to do this. And we'll get back on track. And Jim, thank you for wanting to share more stories and more truth. So,
well, yeah. If I start rambling, you guys bring me in, will you?
Really, man.
So I looked at our last interview with us three, and we lost Rick in the car. And Jim, you kept going and you kept talking about great stuff, and we got it all recorded. And it was good. It all sounded great. So
well, I was very uncomfortable once we lost Rick.
Gosh, what an insult to me, but that's all right. No problem.
Well, you went to the bathroom too, and that really let me out on the limb here.
I wasn't listening at all to you, Jim. I'll be honest, okay?
So, Jim, I had sent you an email earlier about how to do the method of lunar distances for longitude. Did you get that?
They were actually using that in historical times. Lewis and Clark made those observations when they were on the Pacific coast. And yeah, that was a method they used before they got the chronograph working.
Yes, but it also works without a chronograph, and it works to about 15 minutes of arc. So you can be within about 15 miles of wherever you're looking for and have a pretty good longitude.
Yeah, yeah. I think Cook got it down to a half a mile or something like that.
Yes.
A big improvement.
Yep.
Yeah.
So the method, as I understand it, involves using the diameter of the moons, however many diameters of a moon it is between one fixed star and one, let's say the moon, and you calculate that angle compared to an almanac and you get your longitude, or you can get time of day, or you can do both in a roundabout way. But to do it quickly.
Lewis and Clark were quite confused there for a while until they got it figured out. I think they got it figured out. Isn't it so convenient that the diameter of the moon is 1/2 degree?
Yeah, it's very convenient.
It's
so if you had a chain that was engineered so that if you held it at arm's length, it would eat the inside diameter of each link would be the same as the moon. Then you just stretch it between your two points and count the links.
Right, right.
Which makes it incidental, I guess, that so many shipwrecks have a gold chain with lengths the same diameter.
Really? Huh. Yeah, those old timers knew more than we give them credit for, and I think they were very careful not to share what they knew with other people who might get to their ports.
Yes, they were quite secretive about such things. I don't know if you saw my presentation at AAPS about how the Spanish and the Portuguese guarded their not only places, but the resources in those places. And they lied. Yeah. Even the primary sources that we use for history are lies.
Oh, you found that.
Yes.
Yeah, good stuff.
Well, there's I have a bunch of questions, Jim, but I'd like to open it up to you guys first on what you'd like to continue off at, Jim, where we left off, or what you'd like to say in general, or Rick, jump in with what you want to say. So you guys go ahead.
Well, don't turn to me because I can't remember what I did yesterday, and you expect me to remember 3 weeks. So you have to lead with the questions.
Yeah. Prime us a little bit there.
Okay. Well, Rick, I'm debating whether to say it or not. All right. I'll wait for that right this second. So, Rick, are you writing a new book, Rick?
I am. How far do you want me to go with that?
Well, I'm just thinking, I don't know. All right. So Rick's writing a new book. Jim just got back from the Ancient Artifact Preservation Conference. Jim, you're finishing your work on the Torquetum, which we've touched on a little bit, but this is a massive, massive, massively important story. So can you fill Rick and I in just a little bit on the work that you're just about completing?
On the Torquetum?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. First, can we get the title of Rick's book, or haven't you come up with a title yet?
Well, I have a working title. I'll just tell you this. The first chapter is entitled, Where Were You in 82?
1982. Okay.
Yes.
I'll bet Jim's hairs were nice and blonde, weren't they? Maybe a little brown? Amber?
I can't remember. Well, that's pretty pretty open. Can you tell me what the topic is?
Burroughs Cave.
Oh, Burroughs Cave. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah, me too. So in 82 is when it first came to light, quote unquote.
Jim, were you talking about doing a Burroughs Cave book on the images, all of the images, or Rick, was that you?
No, mine was part of it's the images, but the images have been published.
Yeah, we've got back when we were trying to catalog this stuff that hadn't been adequately cataloged. We came up with several hundred photographs. There's 100 in that first book we put together, but there's enough for 2 or 3 other books in the boxes. And Chris, I think you've seen some of those photographs. I think we've got a duty to history to put together everything that came out. It isn't just a few pieces. There are supposedly 1,000, maybe 4,000 pieces. And I know we can document about 400 of them. So yes. Yeah, I want to put that out. That first one that came out, we call Burroughs Cave Images or something like that, Volume 1. Well, there are several more volumes. And there's lots of ideas that were debated and heatedly debated in Isaac and other places. It's time to put that together. This is what happened. This is what these guys right. said. Here's some pictures.
Yeah, I'm kind of pursuing a history of the whole Burroughs Cave phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we're working on the same thing from different ends. Yeah.
Yep.
Did Jim, sorry to jump around a little bit. Did our friend Richie, did he end up listening to the elders, the Native American stories that were on the old cassettes? Did he end up listening to all those? And what did he find?
I think that these stories from the Ho-Chunk Elder, Jones Funmaker, who was the last real keeper of these stories that would go on for hours and hours and hours, or chants. And when he's gone, they're gone. But he shared them with a neighbor, an AES member. And supposedly there are several hours of his songs, his stories in Ho-Chunk. And then those have been preserved, and Richie got the tapes from the Stalings, Donna Staling, who preserved them through all these years. And supposedly they are now copied at Oshkosh or somewhere like that, Green Bay. And he is now trying to get, work out the details with family members to get them translated into English. So it's going on. And if it's done, it's going to be done real well. And it's going to be preserved in various forms. Jones obviously was trying to share something that otherwise would have been lost, and he knew it. So it isn't a matter that you got family secrets here that are going to be preserved until the day they are lost. There will be a family member involved, and will be available, but it won't be right now. It'll take some time.
A thought that I found super interesting, a new thought to me in the last few weeks, was that, you know, some people just don't know the proper avenues, or not proper, just have any avenues, any connections, any ability to share their work, you know, with the masses. So, Jim, I was telling Rick, I listened to Marta Thomas's third annual Pyramid Conference. And there were only 25 people listening to it. Sam Osmanagic of the Bosnian Pyramid spoke, and Dr. Steven Spireson, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And it's, you know, it's just interesting to me that somebody like that would make those tapes and then not have some type of foolproof backup plan to distribute them or assimilate them to the masses. And they just don't. And it's interesting. And I'm just sharing kind of a thought I had that I wish people had better plans to share this stuff while they're living, because those tapes could have very easily been lost to history.
Oh, of course. Exactly. Exactly. And like Richie says, every time an elder dies, we're losing another chapter in our history. And he realizes it, and most of the tribes do. And the time has come, all the way from the Mayans up here, to stop the secrecy and start to share. It was all part of the plan.
And
what they were talking about, the Mayan calendar and so forth, the end of the Mayan calendar, a new era to start.
And so, Rick, I'll let you jump in just 1 second, but I want to say, Jim, tell us about the Mayan shamans, or shaman, that you had an experience with, that basically says, you know, we want to share our secrets. Now is the time. Our kids, all they care about is their iPhones. And I mean, is that true, that these people want to share their secrets?
Yes, very much so. It's part of the native world, which has been kept from the whites for various reasons, because it's a paganism and we'd have to stomp it out back 100 years ago. It started with what they called harmonic convergence. That was before the Mayan calendar ended. And there was a group that met down at Chaco Canyon. I happened to go to that. And that's about when I met Burroughs. He was not involved, but the guy I was with said, you got to get a hold of this guy. He's got stories and stuff. Then the Mayans were coming up to Cahokia, meeting with Merlin Red Cloud and a few of the Ho-Chunk. So they were in contact all across the country. And a Menominee guy by the name of, temple name of Pamita said that shortly, he said, the white buffalo will be born and I can show you more information. When we were surveying down at Lizard Mound Park. And I said, well, it, this area, there's geometry and so on. And he said, I'm the keeper of the site. Yeah, you bet. And he said, I could share a lot more with you, but the time isn't quite right yet. He says, the white buffalo's got to be born first. Well, the white buffalo was born out in Dakota, about 1990, something like that. And it was in a shaking tent ceremony, and it was born in Wisconsin. And the people came back, and the story is that some people in an old pickup truck, Ho-Chunks, that came back from this meeting and drove to the Hyder farm where the buffalo was born, and they found it somehow. It wasn't in the papers yet, and wanted to see the buffalo. Well, a big deal. And then the Mayans learn about it and they come up, and that's where we start to make contact with the Mayans. And the Mayans were in contact with the Ho-Chunk to some extent, but after the white buffalo was born, then it became more formalized. Then the end of the Mayan calendar starts, and actually one of the head Mayan priests did not celebrate the end of the Mayan calendar on winter solstice down in Guatemala in the jungles, but in the temple, but up at Preston Thompson's little wigwam ceremonial area in his backyard. So that's where it started. And we've been in contact various times off and on. The last was on a Zoom meeting like this with an elder down in Mexico. And he said, well, just so you know, I know you've been cautious about these stories, that the Balaam priests, Jaguar priests, have said that the time of keeping all this information secret that we have been trying to preserve has now passed, and it's now time to distribute it. And he says, we need to get in contact the Mayans and the people up here to get it out. So the question is, how do we do it? Everybody's involved and knows the time has come. It's time to change. I mean, it's time to spread the information. And it's just a matter for those of us who are, or you guys who are young enough to do something, can do something to get the word out.
Well,
basically, he said, the time of the secrecy is over. Our priests, Mayan priests, have said this. And so what was forbidden to be talked about a generation ago is now supposed to be carefully disseminated to the world, because they need to know.
Well, some of the Mayans tried to do that 450 years ago. And they were basically chewed up and spit out by the Spanish, because the Spanish couldn't understand it.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. And they didn't want to have anything to do with what they considered paganism, even though they could see the results in front of them. Same thing happened in Peru, but different circumstances. In Peru, people were trying to teach them how to read the quipi, and they couldn't do it. They couldn't understand the context. But some of the Franciscan and other priests noted that they were reading it like a narrative, not just numbers. So, and it went on also with the Maya. The Maya tried to teach the Spanish how to read their codices, and they couldn't get it because they couldn't understand that context dictated the meaning of a word or a symbol.
Yeah, or the authorities of that time, the Inquisition came down there, and anything that wasn't Christianity was of the devil.
Yep.
And therefore, even if you're studying this stuff, you're subject to Inquisition, which, of course, involved torture and burning at the stakes in a lot of cases. So, true.
Condemnation of all kinds.
Yeah, and then you're talking about the keepers and Peru. I've got a part of a book photographed from a priest that was with Pizarro when they came into the observatories there. He says,
"Yep,
they observe the heavens with instruments that we don't know anything all about. Of course, whatever instruments they had got melted down."
Right.
For Vulcan, which is probably now in the church in Barcelona as decorations. But he described how they projected images of the sun. Well, that's what you do with a concave mirror, which is elements of the big telescope, reflective telescopes, which we didn't invent until hundreds of years later, or 100 years later. And in his book, the priest showed where the keepas were kept, and it's decorated on the outside with a planet with rings on it, which is obviously Saturn. And this is before Europeans, quote, invented the telescope.
Very cool, Jim.
Well, you know, if you go back a couple thousand years, there were Greeks and Egyptians and Indians who were using instruments to measure angles to great precision. And yet modern history denies all that.
Working the devil, you know. And also this knowledge was kept not entirely, but primarily for the priests, and the common people weren't supposed to know about it. That includes the geometry in the mounds, which we were able to crack with surveys. And so we've got secrecy in the native traditions, and then we've got our prejudice against anything that's of ancient knowledge in our tradition. It's supposed to be destroyed if we don't understand it or it's not in the Bible. Of course, that's the problem. And you can see why the Indians didn't want to share it. Didn't dare.
Well, they also, yeah, we have 300-400 years of history denying that Native Americans could read or write, and yet we know that they did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Jones was one of the last people who used to write letters in the old Ho-Chunk alphabet. One or two still know about it, but it is about the same as what we'd call Proto-Phoenician before the Phoenicians developed theirs.
And interestingly enough, the same symbols can be used as an alphabet or a syllabary.
Sure.
Well, as well as numerals.
Talking about keepas, in this work on the Torquetum, going in whatever has been written about the Chinese, the people in Tibet and in China at one time were using keepas for their records.
Yep.
So it was,
or a version of it, yes.
Yep.
Now they use something similar, at least for counting, but position and color of the beads on, I forget what that device is called now.
Hecuba?
determines what the total number is, or how you multiply, divide, subtract, etc.
Yeah, which gets us nature to the Torquetum. As near as I can tell, it was developed way before the Europeans got anything at all like the Torquetum, and it was developed in Asia. And of course, they were saying that they shared all that astronomy and calendars with their colonies in this country, which would be the Mayans. Which gets us then to this translation by the Nicholases of the Chinese books. So you want to pick it up here?
Well, Jim, there's something you want to clarify and correct, and for the sake of knowledge to humanity, Gavin Menzies' work in 1421, 1434, and then the Atlantis book, and then finally number four, Who Discovered the America book. What did they get wrong in that needs to be corrected?
Well, that will be in the draft I'm sending you on the Torquetum, because it's so important. His contributions were so great that you can't have glaring mistakes there that would cause people to throw the whole thing out, as Buck has done. But basically, keep in mind, he was a navigator for the Navy, but he was a submarine navigator. And they'd come to the surface with their periscopes once in a while to take observations, which is different than if you are sitting on a stoop waiting for after the sun sets to see a star when it rises, which is about 45 minutes. And one of his major points that obviously people know is wrong is that he interprets some Babylonian records that as soon as the upper limb of the sun sets in the west, the star Aldebaran is right on the horizon in the east. Well, this may be technically correct, but the Babylonians would have had to have swinging plumb bobs or some sort of a short time counter to account for the 45 minutes between when the sun disappears and where the first stars are seen. And he takes that as the fact that you can see these stars immediately when there's still a gleam of sun in the west, which is completely wrong. And then he bases that on how he would say the ancients then could create longitude, and we go off into a spiral that people that study astronomy just chuckle and say, throw his books out. The other is that's misinterpretation, in my view, of what is really in the records and really what the ancients had long ago figured out. But they'd had to have some kind of a clock to do it, and you can't take it at face value without checking it out. And if he had checked it out, it would have been obvious, but he was a submarine commander. The other is that he talks about a site in Portugal, which is a mini Stonehenge. And he said that it was built and used at the same time Stonehenge was. So it was some sort of a navigation astronomy teaching area. And he says this is a unique site because the latitude here is 38.8 degrees. And that is the only, that is where the moon, when it's at its northernmost position in the sky, will shine right down to a bottom of a well. Well, That is also wrong by about 10 degrees.
Yeah, I have to live it.
Anybody who has basic astronomy and so on will know that's wrong. And he says the only other place this happens is up at Scotland, up there. That happens, and he says also at the Stonehenge. Well, it happens in none of these. All that. But hidden there is something even greater. He obviously had his people just go and gather information. He visited, of course, he didn't have time or take the effort to wait around until the moon is at its northernmost point, 18.6 years or whatever it is. To see, but it none of that happens. But what happens is that if you work with the star Vega, Vega indeed comes down, and you could see Vega down that well. And that geometry also relates to Stonehenge, because Vega then glances one of the sides of the Stonehenge, or not Stonehenge, the Pyramid of Egypt, and so forth. So hidden there, hidden, purposely hidden in this is misinformation, but somebody actually checking out knows that it's wrong. So what else will work? And it's Vega, which was the key to the ancient calendars system of the Cheyenne, according to Ralph Red Fox. And it is obviously, it was obviously used worldwide. So those are the two main things. It'll be in, be one of the appendixes of this draft of the book I'm going to show you. But it's got to be straightened out, because he'd made so many good contributions. And he's set that these are real. These are obviously old legends that he never got around to check out.
Isn't that fascinating how we do that? I don't know if I do that, but you basically discredit an entire work because one or two things are wrong. And you see that in comments on websites, and it's just what an interesting process, or somebody would do that.
Yeah, human nature.
Well, I have some big questions, but Rick, can you jump in with something? Would you like to jump in with something to Jim?
Sure. Going with Gavin Menzies and Nicholas's research and all that, we're concentrating primarily on Cahokia for the Nicholas's. Menzies is concentrated on the Pacific Northwest as well as Newfoundland. But let's look at, say, the coast of South America. And the western coast of Mexico, where a number of Chinese period artifacts have been found and discredited by archaeologists because it couldn't possibly be true. Not because they're there, just because it couldn't possibly be true. Any thoughts on that one, Jim?
Well, yeah. It's back to the thing I keep harping on to an annoying degree. We're supposedly in the scientific age where facts authenticated, adequately analyzed, are what comes up with truth. But in many cases, that's our belief system that predominates. And if there is stuff, if analyzed, that might interfere with our belief system, we throw it out. And that is happening in the universities of the world by people who masquerade under the umbrella of science, but throw out the scientific investigation, scientific method. And of course, that gets back to Newton, or for him, Copernicus, and Professor Galileo, who argued that with a telescope, you can see that obviously, the Earth goes around the sun and the planets go around the sun. Well, we believed, No, that wasn't the case. The Pope believed, no, the sun went around the earth.
Is a sinner. Yeah.
Yeah, and he gets imprisoned for life. And then a lot of other people, Bruno gets burned at the stake for maintaining the same position. So the system is in our human nature, and we don't apparently completely benefit from the scientific revolution of Copernicus and Galileo Newton. That's probably because there is half of our universities which are not in the physical science departments or colleges, where they don't talk about the scientific method. And
or even understand it.
Yeah, and in history and art, anthropology are in the humanities, and so they don't get forced exposure to the scientific method, and they behave according to what they think must be the case. And obviously I know that the ancient Chinese could not have gotten to Mexico, so just throw it out, throw out the data, and then gets down to the cocaine mummies and the beetles, tobacco beetles that Menzies goes on about, that they find in Crete. And he says, well, the historians think that if the science comes out with preposterous conclusions, it can be thrown out. And that is not anything that's made up. It is happening and has happened and influences a lot of the thinking that we have yet today in the universities too.
In archaeology and history, we can trace a lot of it back to Major John Wesley Powell, who did not have a degree of any kind except for an honorary, and yet his writings are cited by so many historians and archaeologists as being the truth when it wasn't. For instance, he said, anything that you find out there that has, you know, anything resembles writing, it's almost certainly a fake, because the Indians certainly could not write.
Yep.
They weren't civilized. They were at the barbarian stage.
And same in Wisconsin, since the Indians did not have horses, they find a horse skeleton of a Shetland pony-sized horse in an Indian mound. Automatically, it is a pet Shetland pony, and they didn't examine the date at all on the bones.
Well, another interesting, on that particular dig, one of the things that they did find, and this would have been, I think it was 1952 or so when that dig took place, and it was thrown out because of the horse. However, another item that was found in that dig was an axe that had a wooden handle. And when they finally got around to dating the wooden handle, they found that it was 1,100 years old. And yet it was in the strata right above the horse.
Was this a... iron axe?
No, it was a stone axe, but it still had a handle.
Yeah. Now, have you studied at all the Princess Mound there at Aztalan? She was decorated with amber beads.
Yes, she was. And as well as mica.
And is amber common in this country in burials? I know if we found amber in Newfoundland or England and so on, that was a highly traded item in those days. Why does princess have amber beads? Is that common?
No, I think she probably either was from the Baltic area, or she traded with the Baltic area, because that's where all the amber
to me are. That is something that is out of place from what you normally find in Wisconsin. Why amber, unless she was a highly honored princess, and that at a time when they were trading, the Norse would have been trading. The Norse would have been in this continent at that time.
Yeah, and I don't think that's
a big stretch. The data is completely overlooked because it doesn't fit.
Correct. Much like, I don't know, during my presentation for AAPS, thank you, Chris, for helping me zoom that. In the question and answer period, Frank brought up that in Angel Mounds, which I had mentioned during the presentation, Glenn Black had found a boar's tooth that had been buried ceremonially. And there weren't supposed to be any hogs in North America.
Right. Yeah. So you're the first one to point it out. Nobody else pointed it out.
Well, nobody at IU has pointed it out because it doesn't fit. Yeah. There are a number of things from that, both there and the Bone Bank and a few other sites in southern Indiana that just don't fit.
Mm-hmm. Our paradigm. Helmets. But if you allow, like Pamita said, that there were traders coming here for thousands of years up the rivers and so on, come in the summer and bring the priests, that we would send some of our priests back with them to trade knowledge, then it fits. But that isn't our belief system. So again,
right. It's not the paradigm that fits.
To define what the facts have to be, and the data that doesn't fit is thrown out. As
right. It's doctrinal. Right. It's dogma rather it's than dogma. Scientific.
Exactly. And so we're in a scientific age, but we have been operating with dogma, Christian dogma. And the Indians' dogma, of course, is then of the devil, throw it out. That's the reason I'm sure the Indians have been quiet about it.
Well, it also goes back to the whole manifest destiny thing. Chris and I have been working on a few things in, along that area that can popularize the fallacy of this dogma that we're talking about.
Well, it has to do with taking somebody else's land, and you got to get the people. Pamita said, they called us ignorant savages. We knew all about the world. We're part of a world community, but then they called us ignorant savages because we didn't have read the Bible. We knew it here, he said, but we didn't have your Bible, and therefore we're pagan, and whites had the right to take the land and educate us and bring us to the true religion. And so he said it was just theft. And it was the manifest destiny, and what they taught in schools, he said, was just something to ease the conscience of the people who are stealing when they know they should.
Oh, yeah, I think that's exactly what it was. And you can take it back through the U.S. court systems and see it. The progression of the findings, particularly of the Supreme Court, where Indian land was federally owned land. It never was true. But today it's called the Bureau of Land Management, and it's not the federal government's land.
Mm-hmm.
It never should be.
You've heard of the doctrine of discovery, I'm sure, a papal bull that gave the authority for any Christian to take land of any pagan and enslave him if necessary, or black people even.
Yep.
And so it's legalized slavery and propaganda supported by Powell and the people who supported him and have been supporting him all along. And,
but Powell was certainly somebody else's puppet.
Oh, sure.
Jim, I've never thought that you actually look like John Wesley Powell, but he's a handsome guy, so that's a compliment.
Is that right? But he only had one arm. See, I got two arms.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and maybe if you want people, you know, to hear what you have to say, you know, you got to be a one-arm Civil War hero will help. So,
well, it doesn't matter what I say. It's the facts. If people will realize that truth comes from facts and not from previous beliefs, that's the way you get the truth. If we're in the scientific age now, if we want to get back into the dark age, we just continue fighting about things and we go back that way too.
Well, we'll have to get you in a boat down the what is it?
Colorado River.
Thank you. Grand Canyon. So we'll drop you in from a helicopter, Jim, and then people will start taking you seriously. Okay.
I'm too old for any of that stuff.
Powell did it twice with one arm, but
That's impressive. I mean, if I had two, like, you know, people on both sides propping me up, that would help, but I don't have anybody helping.
Now, do you guys know that Paul's daddy was a minister out New York, upstate New York?
Yeah, Methodist. And that
when the, did you know about this, Rick?
I do.
Okay. Well, then why don't you tell
us? Was, Powell's father's congregation kind of fell apart when so many of them became Mormons. And he became a lifelong enemy of Mormons. And it shows in his work, too. Even in places, it shows in his writings. But Powell had two jobs at one time, both under federal provenance. He was the second director of the USGS, and at the same time, he was the founder and director of the Bureau of Ethnology at the Smithsonian Institution. That gave him the ability to direct where projects would be built, in particular over Native American sites. And deliberately, he would have sites destroyed, even when it was not the best place to put a railroad.
Then suppose that a surveyor like Warwick found what he said were Hebrew writings on the holy stones of Newark. Wouldn't that add argument to the Mormons that there have been people here before? And wouldn't he then want to say these are fake? Crush the data?
Do that.
All right.
My opinion.
Well, so I was, you know, I wonder when that, you know, listening to that ancient pyramid conference, that these pyramids are supposedly so old and way older, you know, I wonder when that became a thing to kind of all of a sudden, you know, not rely on the science and more on the belief system and start the real active push for suppression and the active push for, you know, land acquisition. So I'm watching Alexander, the movie last night, Oliver Stone's 2003 movie, and they're showing a map of the known world. And of course that known world is just, you know, the Near East and, you know, over to India and whatnot. And I wonder if they knew, you know, this is 320 BC, you know, I wonder if they knew about this continent that was over there. I mean, they certainly should have. So I wonder, 320 BC, if they were sharing that with somebody like Alexander. I was just curious about that.
Well, 300 BC, certainly they knew about America. The Chinese would have known, the Minoans and so on. And, but you say sharing, that's to be shared within the family.
Right.
You don't want rebels coming and taking this, getting to your rich port. So then we get into the secrecy and then the propaganda that if you say a lot beyond the Pillars of Hercules, you go over the edge of the world. This continued to some extent almost to the times of Columbus. You know. So you've got misinformation for personal reasons. You can get the public to believe it. And that's been going on.
Even 18th century maps still showed sea monsters in a lot of the Atlantic. So when you think about what all those things on those maps meant, that takes me back to the Delisle map that Meriwether Lewis kept looking for, couldn't find one. But it was a 1716 map prepared for the French king, or when he would become king, the Dauphin, and it almost certainly had a narrative that went with it. But on the map were a bunch of stuff that didn't make any sense to a map maker. You had two different systems of longitude portrayed on this map. You had different spellings, different capitalization of words that a truly educated guy like Delisle would not have done unless he was doing it on purpose to convey some message. So these maps that where you see sea monsters and different things that don't make any sense, it made sense to the person who knew what he was looking at.
Hmm. Yeah, and then we go to the Chinese maps. And again, we need to give a lot of credit to Menzies taking the time after he retired to dig through the Chinese records. Supposedly maps from 1418 or something like that, way before Columbus. I can't remember seeing any sea monsters on them. Have you observed are the sea monsters just part of the propaganda? The Chinese weren't part of it, it appears to me.
I would have to relook at the re-examine those maps, but I've noticed it on the quote unquote Western world maps from everybody, even the Arabs did things like this. They had secrets that they conveyed the meaning to people who knew how to read it.
Wow.
In ancient Greek, it would have been what we call steganography, message hidden in plain sight.
Well,
what do you call it? Steganography?
Steganography, yes. And it comes from, as far as the Greek meaning and the Greek root of the word, it comes from a case where a Greek, I'll call him noble, was held hostage for years by another king, but he was able to convince that king that his slave needed to go home to visit his parents or whatever. And in the meantime, he had tattooed a message on the guy's scalp and let the hair grow back out so that when he got home, he shaved his head and they could read the message.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the origin of our modern version of steganography. In modern times, in the last 30 years or so, it's hidden within digital data, particularly within JPEG files, where they've added just bits here and there to make up a message that, if you have the right software, you just pull it out of the image.
Reminds me of pulling the geometry out of these mounds and what's hidden in the old Tarkatan.
It is certainly the same concept.
Yeah. It isn't going to be in plain sight. It's going to be hidden in plain sight.
Correct.
Redford, great. Thanks.
And go ahead.
No, go ahead, Chris.
No, I just wonder, you know, in these ancient times when supposedly these pyramids were, you know, a real harmonious place or for meditation or healing and communication, you know, that these pyramids, I wonder if that knowledge was shared with everybody back then, you know, rather than this suppression that started, you know, millennia later, I guess. Just when that suppression started or.
Well, I think you got both. If my 30 years studying Indian mounds mean anything, is that the sites were to be used by everybody. But Pamita said the geometrical secrets are hidden, the little stones and stuff like that that the common person would overlook. And he said that the secrets were hidden at the time the mounds were constructed by the people hauling the dirt. Only the priests knew it. So I think both things were going on. Public use and then hidden in there, higher information that only the priests could access by verbal initiations or by understanding the code to look through it.
And I believe the initial word for priest was magician, right? But go ahead, Rick.
Okay, I'll dispute that. The magi, from which we get the word magician or magic, was a priesthood more closely associated with the modern Zoroastrian religion. We don't have to go into what all that meant, but the magic part was they could use signs, portents, instruments, whatever they used to make predictions, not just astronomical, but societal. Even down to, in some cases, individuals. And it was the Magi who knew that Jesus of Nazareth was born and when and where. Somehow they had that knowledge, but he was also the heir to the king of Israel. So an important personage, regardless of the whole religious part. Now, going back to who knew what and when, I think that society, as we know it, has always been striated in such a way that the uppity ups were in the business of hoarding knowledge. Still are, by the way. And that fake news is not a new phenomenon.
And, You think so?
Carl Sagan, one of my least favorite astronomers, made a very cogent statement one time when he said that religion was born on the day that the first charlatan met the first gullible fool. And I think it's probably the truest thing that Carl ever said. Was he smart? Yeah, he was smart. He was smarter in that regard, I think, than he was even in cosmology. But nevertheless, the Magi and their kin were somehow capable of making these predictions. If we go back to, say, ancient Rome, and I'm talking the Republic, even before the Republic, the Kingdom of Rome, they had these people, females, usually virgins, who could talk to the gods or could convey messages from the gods and could send messages to the gods for the right price, of course. Kind of like, I don't know, internet. But they had some means of knowing what was going on someplace else in very near real time. So whether it was a message of, you know, pulsed signals of light or, you know, sounds coming through the caves under Rome, and there are some, we don't know what technology or infrastructure they used, but we know that somehow they got all this right. And everybody who wasn't in on this considered it to be magical. Just like Isaac Asimov said, to the uninitiated, any sufficiently sophisticated technology will appear to the uninitiated as magic.
I wonder if those Jesuits that were converting or attempting to convert Indians, you know, back in the day were... you know, obviously there's a wide spectrum of people believing and not believing, but I wonder if they really believed what they were trying to do and felt they were doing the right thing, or, you know, it was just do as they're told.
I think it was some of each, particularly with Jesuits. There was a point where they could not break the dogma. They could not buck the system that much. But if you go to the oracles from 3,000 years ago, give or take, they were making predictions that came true. Whether it was somebody's going to attack or whatnot, they had their own system of intercommunication that was separate from the nation states. It was a religion from all outward appearances, but it was a network of communications. And I think it was all over the world, not just Rome and Greece and, you know, those places. What do you think, Jim?
Well, I agree. Well, instantaneous in the days when it would take, you know, generations to migrate, if you had somebody in boats who could go across the ocean and
in weeks,
and bring back the information and share them with these virgins and stuff like that, who would advise the kings and so on, that's another possibility. I don't think we need UFOs necessarily to explain all of this, because you give some people a 200-foot-long boats and sails and a crew who knows how and where to go, a lot of this communication, I think, was just routine. And that's what Pomita would say, that they were coming here from the East Sea and the West Sea every summer. We sometimes went back with them. And then you get to South America and you get the evidence of people long before the Mings from China being there. And then India saying that we were sailing at one time before we had a big civil war and we destroyed our culture. Religious civil war, by the way.
Yep.
Yeah. And so, so give people boats and let them navigate. And don't make the ocean a barrier, but a highway. And I think this picture is a lot different, but that's not, of course, what we were taught when I was a boy.
Yeah, nobody could navigate. Nobody could build a boat that could stay out for 3 months without sinking. Nobody could supply enough food to last on the ocean for 3 months. And oh, by the way, it only took 3 weeks if you knew where you were going.
Right.
The Pacific was a little different, but if you hugged the rim, you could always resupply.
And there really was a Northwest Passage, and it's still there, and sport sailors still sail it. Yep. You wouldn't go with a 200-foot boat, but a 100-foot boat. And we never found it. The Indians know about it. It's encoded in the directions at the Bighorn Medicine Wheel. So, you know, some people have said that the only things we don't know about is a history that we never learned. And in some cases,
and a lot of it is deliberately hidden
from us.
Yeah, deliberately hidden. And I'm kind of anxious for the, not just the Native Americans, but also the old cultures of the old world. And I'm including Australia in that, where they can all at some point get together and tell their side.
Oh yeah, but the interesting thing is that the Chinese and the Koreans and so on, my daughter teaches people from those countries who want to come here for schooling and teaches English to them for a year before they launch. And they said, well, we knew all about, we've got hundreds of books that talk about coming to America. And you guys believe Columbus discovered America. It's like Santa Claus. So we don't even pay any attention to you in that matter. And we don't argue, of course.
And so real, you know, we could absolutely, and we are, and we will prove, you know, the ancient seas being the highways and, you know, the ancient travel and, you know, big part of my life and your guys' life. And we focus on certain topics and situations and become obsessed in that. And I can't help myself, but what I learned this weekend from this pyramid conference is that, you know, we're talking numbers like 20, 30,000 years ago, you know, the Ho-Chunk's talking two ice ages ago, you know, we're talking 20, 30, 40, 50,000 years, Michael Cremo's work up to, what is it? A million years ago. So in trying to jump into the minds and the psychologies of these people that you were living 50,000 years ago, I guess I'm just throwing the question out there. But the last thing that I want to say is, you know, we just don't know. It's one thing that for thousands of years we're traveling the oceans, and that is just earth-shattering, history-changing. We are proving that, no doubt about it. But add a zero to the time periods going back and back and back, and was there a better concept of telepathy? You know, did you not even need to travel across the oceans to relay a message, to communicate something? Like, it's real possible that there is just so much that we are kept from or not shared, you know, from those time periods that, you know, that that needs a lot more attention, what was going on back then. So
let me just jump in with one thing. And that is that on the island of Crete, They have dated stone tools to 120,000 years before present, and you cannot and could never walk there.
Makes you suspect they had boats, doesn't it?
Hey, sure enough. Okay. Or they were excellent swimmers. I don't know. But.
So, yeah, that's the one of the points I think is really important is give them boats, but give them an early time, not when we want them to have boats. And a lot of these mysteries then start to disappear. As to these ancient ages, well, once the white buffalo was born in Wisconsin, Mayans come up and they had conference and they actually had sessions for a weekend and we could ask questions. And then they had around a fire pit at night, they taught us the Mayan calendar the same way they teach kids in their country. And here you got these weeks, 13 days in a week, and then 26. And I knew that 26 was key to the Mayan calendar along with some other things. And so I asked them, why is this emphasis on 26? And the guy there who spoke a little English or went through a translator, and he says, well, that's because of this long time period. And he pointed up at the sky. And I say, you knew about the 26,000 year precession? Oh yeah, we've been here for two cycles, 52,000.
1,000 years, yeah.
And that of course is parallel to Europe. So it indicates to me they had communication, but we came here 52,000 years ago from across the sea. I was sure glad there was no archaeologist at that meeting because at that time, 13,000, and they were pushing 26,000 at that time. But the dogma was they all walked across, Indians walked across the Bering Straits without getting their feet wet. No boats.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But you can go back to the Anasazi out there in far western British Columbia. They have a mountain and ash from when that mountain erupted that covered a village. And archaeologically, that the Anasazi, have discovered 72 to 75,000 years old. So somebody was here even before the Maya.
And so
what they also believe that. They also believe that humankind originated in North America.
Well, Pamita said we were part of a Camaral community, and a lot of the knowledge that you have in Europe was cooked up here.
I agree.
2,000 year calendar, 5,200 year calendar cycle of the Mayans is the same as the Yuga cycle in India. And in India, they say, where did this Yuga calendar come from? It's almost identical to the Mayan calendar, just offset by a few years. We got it from a guy who was of the Maya clan.
And also took him corn.
Oh, yeah, and corn gets there, sure. Yeah. Yep. Give them boats. You got to give them boats. I don't see any reason we should treat insisted that the ancients didn't have boats at a very early time.
There are at least four different stone monuments in Maya country that depict elephants.
Yeah.
In particularly, they depict Asian elephants.
Yeah. So we can either say, well, that came from mental telepathy, or just let a couple artists from India get on one of the boats that were coming here for tin or whatever it was they were getting in gold in South America. I don't see any problem. The data is there. I don't think we have to throw it out just because it's contrary to our beliefs.
You guys all seem very calm, and maybe years of being told that you're, you know, basically a fool for thinking that people had boats, you know, 1,000 years ago. I can't help but kind of just relay a few of these other things that I heard, which is the precision of these pyramids is so precise to, you know, magnetic north, to true north, to the evolving plate, you know, where true north was, where magnetic, that they were so intelligent back then. And this was right around the time that we're basically saying they were just cavemen, right? So they couldn't possibly have built such intelligent things. They were dumb cavemen. And so this fabulous quote that it was basically, you know, up until very recently, it was this 4,500 BC number or 6,500 BC number, you know, of, I believe, Mesopotamia. And that was kind of where things started. And I think I'm saying that approximately correct. But then 10 years after that, they kind of revised it to add another 1,000 years to it. They're like, oh, well, it actually started there 1,000 years before we thought. So they were so intelligent to have built these pyramids. And we basically just, you know, that's it.
Well, you talk about the extreme age of the Bosnian pyramid. I contend pretty strongly that the Great Pyramid of Egypt is far older than any of the other pyramids in Egypt. And it is a contemporary of the Bosnian pyramid, which would make it some 35,000 years old. And I'll take some secondary related evidence, if you will, and that is that this Great Sphinx, which sits out there just east of the pyramid, is probably 35,000 years old. And that's not just by the geological wear and tear on the bedrock, it's also by the age of an apparent Sphinx cult that spanned everything from Central Europe down to the middle of Africa. And artifacts of that age, including wooden artifacts that were easily carbon dated, are that age. So my contention is that the Sphinx drove, the Sphinx cult probably built the pyramid in Egypt. Who built it in Bosnia, I don't know, but I'll bet it was somehow related to them.
Yeah, let's take the image of the Sphinx. Man's head on a lion's body. Kind of funny thing. But in India, Mohenjo-Daro, there's lots of interesting stuff coming out there by very qualified people. And they're sharing it on the web if you can get contact. They're saying that there was a major shipbuilding port there at Mohenjo-Daro before the pyramids were built. And that they were making sawn plank boats and have lots of records of trading for copper and for tin and smelting and so on. But of course, they cut all the trees off. The place became denuded. But through other contacts with traditions from the Mideast or from India and so on, the Sphinx was a symbol of the people who drove the ships. And interestingly, there was a brass sphinx found near Astolin, Wisconsin. Unique, unless you accept the sphinx that was found down in, down south along the Arkansas River. But this is real. It's in a private collection. So what the hell is going on? Well, this is a symbol of people who drove boats. And that The Mohenjo-Daro system was fully developed starting to fall about the time the pyramids of Egypt were built. So there's a symbol there of the Sphinx, to me, that is telling us something. And then it gets back to, you know, where did it all start? Well, I think Menzies brings a good point. He says, any trade to this country for copper would have not been from one city-state, but from a trade empire, sort of like the British Empire was before he retired.
Oh, I agree with that completely.
Yeah, and then as to how smart those people were, the people back at that time, 20,000 years ago, I don't know for sure, but certainly 10,000 years, they're just as smart as we are and probably smarter. They had bigger brains than the Neanderthal. And give them a boat and let them sail around, and then those that get back home know how to navigate by the stars, and then they develop the navigation and astronomy, and just don't suppress them. Say you can't do it. And many of our mysteries that we now try to explain by UFOs could be also explained by people in boats that knew how to navigate. And they were smart in those days. And then if they have a successful trade empire, then you can get them together to build monuments to the people that they think are sons of the gods, so that the son, the relative of our king, can be influenced, and so we won't have floods and stuff like that.
Well, I do know there's some big pyramids that are covered in vegetation in China. I was wondering why I don't think that I heard of too many in India, although I'm maybe incorrect in that. I wonder why that is.
Oh, there are. But at least two of them are buried on purpose. You can still see the shape. They're out in the desert part of India. There's probably a whole bunch of them in the jungle part, but nobody's actually discerned that. It would take LIDAR and other satellite imagery to pull them out, much like we do in the Yucatan. Before people started using LIDAR to find what are they up to, 30,000 different sites in the Yucatan now, I was using Landsat photos to pick them out. And you could see a lot of the larger structures you could see with Landsat.
I'd like to throw out just a random thought. I heard that, you know, about 12,000 years before present, you had the melting of the glacier, right? Which caused the water to run down the Mississippi. This was George Gale down in Louisiana at his site taught about this. And so you have all the water that's running down the Mississippi. Would that have led to some type of an exodus of the people living around that area that perhaps would have gone down to Central or Mexico or South America? Or is that not the origin or migration of the Olmecs, Mayans, et cetera?
No, the Olmecs came along 6,000, 7,000 years later than the big melt. But there was a second melt. The big melt started in 12,000 and it got cold again. And then it got warm again, the Younger Dryas period, if you want to go with that one. But most of that melt in North America went out the St. Lawrence Seaway, or it went out the Columbia River or Snake River, out that way. As far as the Mississippi is virtually, the valley is virtually undisturbed by major water flow until white man started digging ditches. Just seriously.
Very good. And Jim, what do you think on the origins of the Maya, the Olmec? Just where, what do you think?
Well, again, they came by boats. You don't have to migrate, you know, on land. The Olmecs were at a port city down there, or port area, La Ventra. And let's see, there was a guy from Pakistan years ago, he used to come to Isaac meetings, Drazaboy or something like that. And he said there were 13 things that his study showed of the Ulmics that came up very suddenly, not this traditional going from a spear to something else and so on. He says in there came writing, calendars, pottery, and all sorts of, he says these have to be transplants by boats. And then he went on to the big heads and stuff like that. But at the same time, we have up in the UP, or not the UP, in northern Minnesota, what we call a dolmen site. A dolmen on the shortest portage between the Mississippi and the waterways
in, Hudson Bay.
Into Hudson Bay, and then you're in Hudson Bay if you know where to go and follow the dolmens, you can get into the Northwest Passage. And this was right where outcrops of magnetite come in. And right there you can see this big vein, and the compass goes 360 as you walk around it. And the Ulmics were into compasses, some of the early people. So I always think, well, the people interested in this would obviously be the Ulmics. And then as to the Mayans, there are people who have studied the writings and stuff. And even the Ulmic writings, there's writings there that Chinese have been able to say, we can read this in the ancient Shang. Not only is it similar, this is Shang. So we get back then to the Chinese being here. And the Chinese had boats too, and they knew how to navigate. So I tend to think, as Pamita said, we were part of a world community and we knew it. And we traded and shared knowledge across the Eastern and the Western seas. And traders would come in the summer and they'd bring educators, and we would send our priests and educators back, and we taught over there. Medicine was our big contribution, and I think surveying and navigation was as well. But I know he said that the main contribution was medicine. And he said, we're part of a world community. And this is parallel to what Menzies is saying, that those people who traded across the Atlantic were a confederation. They were like the British Empire and no one city state. And obviously there were people coming the other way. In the legends, this is called what, Lemuria, or again, not a particular city state. Right. But
it's like the Hanseatic League. They didn't have a national patriotism. They had a self-patriotism.
Yeah. And so if you're going to have something like that, that could be very successful, you can't be fighting all the time. And then you start fighting, and then that ends it. It's the picture of the Minoans. It's a picture of the people from India, when they say they ruled the seas, and then they had a religious battle over some sacrifices in the temple, and it ended.
Well, Jim, incredible job sharing, incredible session, Rick. We're going to wrap this up for today, and then we're going to continue this. Just I'll send you guys another time here in the next, you know, two days or so. Just thank you very much, and important stuff to get out. I feel great that we've recorded this forever and can share this with a lot of people. So
thank you for setting this up and letting us share among ourselves and rant about our favorite theories.
Well, it's going to it's going to continue with some more questions. I still haven't asked my my big ones, Jim. So, Rick, a few days, we'll do this again.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Well, let you kids take care of it. And let me know when you want to have another.
All right, Jim.
Good seeing you, Jim.
Good seeing you. Yeah.
Thanks, buddy. Bye.
Bye. Bye.